If you hear snorting and gruff sounds in the background, it's my dog Mo. She's sleeping, and so she every once in a while she scratches and pushes out and makes noises, and it's not my stomach growling or me snorting, it's my dog.
Hey, Simon.
Hello,
Simon.
Hey,
Hello.
Simon.
What's up,
Simon?
Simon?
How you doing?
Hello. Hey, Simon.
Aloha,
It's Skylar.
Simon.
How you doing?
Hello,
Hello,
Simon.
Simon. Hello.
Hey,
Hey
This
there.
Simon.
is Conversations
Hello,
with
Simon.
Storytellers, a podcast of wisdom, thoughts, and folk and fairy tales from our elders, and I am your host, Simon Brooks, and today I have a bit of a head cold. This is a meeting with professional storytellers. I decided to travel around the country when I could to interview some of the elders in the community of traditional storytelling. Each storyteller shares their thoughts on our profession and gems of wisdom, and sometimes a story or two. I'm glad you're here. I had heard of Shona Lee, but I'd never heard her stories. Then Mara Menzies told me about her. British storyteller Shona Lee comes from an old Jewish tradition. She is a Dritzella, who was taught by her grandmother Buba, Edith Marks, around 3,000 stories. These stories are told traditionally in cycles. There are 12 cycles, and each cycle has 8 sub-cycles, and each of these sub-cycles contain between 120 and 300 stories, if I got that correctly. Some stories are short, but some are incredibly long, and the stories date from around 5 BCE until around 17th century. They make the Odyssey look like a Saturday morning cartoon. Shona Lee is a wonderful and funny lady. I was very excited to talk to her. So, without further ado. The lady I'm about to talk to has a library inside her head. And when I say that, I don't mean like the library behind me of 250 books. I'm talking about, you know, the Library of Congress library in her body. She knows about 3,000 stories. Please welcome Shona Lee.
Thank you very much. It's great to be welcomed. I was never very good in academia, but yeah, you're absolutely right. I had so many stories in my head that had so much common sense. I didn't really need it a lot of the time.
Well, there you go. Hey, I might use that line myself.
Feel free, my friend. Feel free.
So those of you who are listening, you'll probably realize that she's not an American. She's actually British. And you come from originally, because you said you come from up north, but you originally come from further down south by the sound of it.
Much further. Much further than you're thinking as well, Simon. But my family come from Enschede in the Netherlands, and I lived there till I was 7, and then I moved to London, or the outskirts of London, where I lived for quite a few years. But I now live, some would say God's own country, Yorkshire. I live actually on the border in Bronte country, which is rather lovely, northeast Derbyshire.
Bronte country? Well, that's, I'm sure there's a few listeners that will like and be envious about that.
Wuthering Heights, 7 minutes from our back door, you know. You
oh,
can
really?
Wander around and look wistful, pale and interesting. It's quite marvellous.
So you started off in the Netherlands. The Netherlands is a beautiful place.
Oh, yes, it is glorious. And interestingly enough, quite flat, but excuse me. Even to this day, I work best when I can see a horizon.
Really?
You know, if I can see a horizon, or I'm walking. A lot of my tradition is about walking, walking, walking the story. You don't learn the story from text. You walk, walk, walk. To be able to walk and to see horizons, or be in that vast expanse of space, where the light is changing and the sounds are coming at you from different angles and different times of day. So So yes, I go back there a lot. I work over there quite a bit, and I love it. I just love it so much. And but I also love where I live as well. It's hard, isn't it, when you're traveling for work as well, because you see so much majesty around the place, but it's also different.
It is. You get to meet all sorts of different people that have different ideas of certainly in the States, you know. I mean, having grown up in the UK, I know that there's a lot of difference and variety in the UK, but I haven't lived there for about 30 years, so I'm sure things have changed a lot. But yeah, people are different all over the place. You can just, you know, go an hour away and people are different. So growing up, did you I know you heard a lot of stories. Where did you hear
Just a few.
where did you hear the stories from?
All around, actually. I'm mainly my bubba, my grandmother. But our house was full of stories, full of music. My grandfather was a musician, my aunt was a singer. So there was always music and story. But my bubba was a Drittziller, so she held this tradition. And I think because the community that she would have originally have served as a didn't exist anymore. You know, after the war, those communities didn't exist. So she kind of poured it into me, and the house was always full of story. But every day I would be learning stories, crashing stories, walking stories.
So the Drittziller, that they would have been the storyteller for the community, is that right?
Yes, it's peculiar to the Netherlands. I get a lot of
Oh, I didn't know that.
academics going, "Oh, we've never heard of this." And because I'm a famous academic and I've never heard of it, it obviously doesn't exist. And I think that's really sweet, actually. But yeah, it was peculiar to the Netherlands, and it was so run-of-the-mill. It was like, you know, those red cups, those red disposable cups you have in the States. Would you cherish those? No. 90% of them probably end up in landfill. And I think the tradition was like that. The women learnt it. It was an oral tradition. It was not that cherished because it was just something you did every night. You listened to stories, and the stories ran in cycles. And so they were just commonplace. But once those communities, like anything, started to disappear, the people that told those stories really started to disappear. And because it was a woman's tradition and an oral tradition, you can imagine being a little Jewish old lady, or even a young Jewish lady, because my bubba would have only been in her 30s, I guess. Been in the war, your chances of survival in Europe were pretty slim. So it went from being very commonplace on people's tongues. First World War, big movement of people, big changes in communities. So it became a little less vibrant or robust. And by the end of the Second World War, it was pretty much extinct.
That's yeah. And that, yeah, that's yeah. It's you know, I look at what's going on in the world today, you know, and it's a lot of these traditions, you know, when people are scattered and broken up, right? That's what happens, right? Their culture is torn apart, and those stories are lost, and their culture's lost, even, right? So
Yeah, have
your grandmother, she told you a lot of stories. Did she tell your mother these stories as well, or did your mother
No,
know of these?
the tradition works that it goes from grandmother to granddaughter.
Oh.
Now, there are reasons for that, which I can explain if you'd like.
Yes, please.
okay, so the tradition would be passed down from grandmother to the eldest granddaughter, basically. And that's for two reasons. If you think about it, in a traditional family at that time, the mother would have been possibly running the business. You know, things open to a lot of Jewish families were innkeeping or trading, or, you know, all of these things. She would have been helping run the business. She would have had about 10 children, and she would have been running a home. She would not have had the time to pass it on.
Yeah.
That's quite a practical thing. And also, if you think about it, you have a different relationship with your grandparents that you do with your parents.
That's true.
Very different relationship.
So the grandparents it have with their grandchildren as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, so yeah. my mum started to learn the tradition from her grandmother, but with the outbreak of things in Europe, my bubba bribed somebody, because my aunt had got married and come to the UK. It was a source of great consternation in the family, because she'd married this guy and they hadn't totally approved, and she'd gone to the UK. But it meant that she had relatives in the UK. So my bubba bribed one of the people on the last kinder transports going out of Europe to take my mum. And so my mum went and lived with her aunt for the whole of the war. But what that meant was, she didn't get any more of the tradition. She didn't
Great.
Get any training and the stories. And
how old was your mum then?
Let's see. I think she was about 11.
Okay.
12, something like 11 or 12. I don't know, 20 or 39. Yeah, she would have been sort of that sort of age group. I know she was old enough to carry a baby, because that's what they wanted. They'd got babies and they needed people to carry babies.
Right.
And a lot of the kids that went over carrying babies had to come back.
Oh my gosh.
The UK didn't let them in. But because my mum had got a relative and a letter, she went, and so she spent her war in Wapping Docks. But that, as I often say, is another story for another time. But yeah, so that was interrupted for her. And then after the war, my bubba was in the camps and they were liberated. And I think a lot of people think, oh, that must have been, you know, this wonderful kind of romantic story. And it really wasn't, because you had to be tested for TB first before you were allowed to move anywhere. And so many families that had survived and been reunited had to split up again, because you couldn't go to America if you tested positive for TB. You couldn't go to Europe, anywhere else in Europe. But my bubba was clear, and so she came to the UK for a bit. And then eventually, when I was born, in the 70s, she was my primary carer.
That's awesome.
And I think that's why I got the tradition, you know, because there was no community. Excuse me, there was no community that I could have served as a Dritz Hitler. They didn't exist. But my brother always used to say it was the stories that kept her sanity.
And I bet.
She just poured them into me, and she poured the training into me, and the cycles, and the way to remember them, and the way to ask questions, and the way to walk with them. And so she did that from the age of about 4. So I don't think I'm anything spectacular or even clever. It's just like anything. I got the bag of sweets really early. Or I got the training, you know. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time at the right age, you know.
Yeah. And that's
and it wasn't
definite.
All this magical. Do you ever get people cut some off on things? It must be marvelous to be a traditional bearer. It must be so lovely. It's bloody. Oh, I'm not allowed to swear, am I?
That's all right.
Can you edit that out? In England,
no.
That's not swearing.
I know, it's not. It's fine.
Flipping not. Because there were times I wanted to go out and play and do exciting things, and my brother would say, you've just got to learn this a bit first, and then you can. And I didn't want to. Now I look at it and I'm so glad. And
Right.
it's like I've started to take them to my son, and somebody said to my son, because my son doesn't want to be a storyteller, he wants to be a lawyer.
Well, yes, you know,
And
I've said this before on this show, but as storyteller Bill Harley here, he's down in Rhode Island.
I know Bill, yeah.
So he says the difference between a family-sized pizza and a storyteller is that a family-sized pizza can feed a family of four.
Yeah, so for
I can
somebody,
understand your son wanting to be a lawyer and not a storyteller.
well, that's what he says. He says, I don't want to have to tell the stories, I want to tell them because I want to tell them. And somebody said to him one day, Isaac, because he's in his 20s, why do you want to learn the stories? And he just went, I don't. And they went, well, why are you learning them then? And he said, because my 40-year-old self came and visited me and said, if you don't learn the stories and the wisdom and the common sense that they contain, I am going to kick your butt round the park. So he said, I'm actually not learning them for me, I'm learning them for my 40-year-old self.
That's awesome that he has that sense, because there are some people that, some 20-year-olds, teenagers, 20-year-olds, whatever you want to, they're not interested in that, right?
No, they're not. No,
That's
but
awesome.
it's he says it actually helps him with his hobbies. I think they are so relevant. Do you ever get the thing, oh, what relevance are traditional stories in today's world? And you go,
Oh my gosh, yeah.
have you ever met a soldier that can't speak of what they've seen? Have you ever met a child that's been abandoned? Have you ever met somebody that needs a dream or needs magic to carry on? Of course, they're flipping irrelevant.
Or even hope, right? Even something as little as hope. I mean,
My bubby had a saying, which a lot of people use, and if you'd like to use it, you are also welcome. She used to say, her name was Edith Marks, if you ever want to give her a check. She used to say, not every story, she would say, Liebling, not every story has a happy ending, but every story that you walk must begin with outrageous hope. Love
Oh,
that
I love that.
phrase.
I do too. And there's a quote that you have from her on your website, which I also liked, which is, "When the world is crying, it doesn't need more tears. It needs a handkerchief."
Yes, she was very, very practical like that. I
Yeah.
have so many sayings of hers.
So you're going to do a book of her sayings?
I'm about to publish one, actually.
Yay, that's awesome.
It's going to be called Bubba's Wednesday Wisdoms, and
Oh,
because
okay.
she used to come out with some just cracking ones,
Yeah.
I've got one here actually that I wanted to share with you.
Okay.
And it says, people who don't know about storytelling think that telling a story is like singing a song. The singer sings, the teller tells, the listener listens. But if the singer was singing on top of a mountain miles away from anyone, they could still sing the same song. Storytelling isn't like that. The storyteller is like a musician, but the listener is his instrument. The listener is like a violin, and the story is like a bow.
That I love that because it's true. I mean, how
Yeah.
often do we sing for ourselves and give ourselves joy? But trying to tell a story to yourself, it's you
Yeah.
can't tell, you need a story needs an audience.
Well, I think a story is a dialogue.
Yeah,
I
it
think
is.
it is a
I totally agree.
dialogue between you and whoever is listening,
Yeah, it is.
definitely. So yes, I think, I mean, I find it fascinating because again, you have people that because we don't call them fairy stories, we call them wonder tales.
Oh, and this is in the Jewish tradition.
Yes, and in Europe a lot as well. I mean,
Okay.
if you, I mean, they are called fairy stories, but that kind of came in with Grimm,
Right, it is. Yeah.
But up till then, you had myths, you had legends, you had wonder tales, you had folklore,
Right.
and folk tales are exactly what it says on the tin. It's tales of the folk, isn't it? And folk tales teach you street smarts,
Yes, they do.
effectively. You know, I say to some of my students, they go, "Oh, it's like they're magic, they're wonderful." And I go, "Well, if you think about it, if they were there to teach you morals, Jack and the Beanstalk would be there to teach you that it's all right to invade someone else's country, it's all right to kill, it's all right to steal, and stupidity is its own reward." That's not what it's there. It teaches you street smarts, how not to be dumb, how to, and wonder tales teach you about magic, and magic teaches you, as we were saying earlier, about hope, how to survive in a relentless world, how to have a dream that will, eventually bring you forward.
I think it's I think it's also related to faith. No matter what faith you come from, I think wonder tales, that magic in some way is a form of faith, right?
Yes,
It's a
and
form
I.
of faith in the world around us to, if we're open to it, to come to our rescue. And I'm a firm believer that's the case. If we're open to the world around us, then
I believe
magic
I
happens.
actually totally believe the stories while I'm telling them. Totally. I totally believe them. There are so many of them, and they have seen me through so much, and taught me so much in a way that, having someone point out the obvious wouldn't have done. Do you know? Sorry,
Go
just
on. No, go
segueing into a small rantette here.
on.
I was 16 years old before I ever read a story where a woman had to be rescued from a tower. I've never read that before. I mean, my stories, there's a story about the walnut girl, and she strides around. Nobody else can rescue the prince. She rescues a prince from a shedikim, which is kind of a quite a predatory kind of demon chaos entity. She rescues him. He falls in love with her and goes, "I meant to marry you." And she goes, "Well, I don't want to marry you, mate. I'm the walnut girl, and I was born for adventure." And off she goes, you know.
Well, it's kind of like Tatterhood is a bit like that, right? I mean, the two sisters do end up getting married, but it was on their terms, right?
Yes, and there's
It, it,
so much that's empowering that's been damped down,
right.
and Disneyfied. Sorry, I'm going to upset some of your listeners now.
No, that's fine.
Or, Disney's lovely, bless them. But
Yes.
they do tend to Disneyfy everything.
They
It's
do.
like, and that's not how the world is. And I think the stories that I inherited were as sandy and as bitter and as, and I'm going to say the word dirty, and I don't mean dirty as in salacious. I mean
Right.
dirty as in the world is not a clean place.
Right. Getting your
Decisions we
hands
make are not
dirty.
clean.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so those stories have to reflect that. And I think sometimes we want all our stories to be lovely. But how do we learn, from stories? And so you can tell a story that you don't like, I think, as long as you're not standing up on a stage and you kind of, you, I mean, I always invite discussion whenever I tell a story. I was like, "How do you feel about that? What do you think about that?" I love it when in the UK and in Europe, people are so used to my style. People will interrupt me while I'm telling to ask questions. And that's perfectly normal for a Dritzilla. I absolutely love that. Freak my husband out, who's a folklorist.
Oh, yes.
He often joked that his only way to get his hands on the tradition was to marry it. Oh, how we laugh. What a romantic. It doesn't
Academic,
keep
is
me.
he?
Yeah, bless him, yes. He's my tame appa. I'm a professional wordsmith, he's my tame academic. But yes, so I'm used to that. But I've seen it happen a couple of times, and it completely freaked people out. So it's like, that's not in the script. But
Right.
it's not a script. It's a story. It's a
It's,
dialogue. You
yeah.
don't wake up and go, right, these are the conversations I'm going to have today.
Right.
And if it doesn't fall into that remit, I can't have them. I think that's what story does. It causes a dialogue. And so, yes, I've gone off totally off tangent. Can't remember
No,
what I was
you
talking
haven't. It's
about. Haven't I? Oh,
no,
great.
no,
And
because
then you've
I
got
think it's true
some.
because when I when you know when storytellers go and tell stories to school kids,
I've
you
heard
know,
lots of different things, yeah.
it's the same thing. The kids will be, they'll interrupt, right? And the teachers,
And they want to interrupt, yes.
yeah, and
I
sometimes.
remembered what I was going to say, yes. So I think if I got art and told a story about a complete misogynist, and then, swept off stage to great applause, it's like I'm condoning that story.
Right, yeah.
But I remember telling there is a story, there's a story about this horrendous man who has an iron tongue, interestingly enough. There's another story about somebody who has glass heart. And this young lass said to me when I finished, "I hate that story." And I went, "Great, why?"
Yeah.
And they had all these objections, and we sat there for the next 3 hours over a coffee. And I think it was a bit worrying for the organisers who kept trying to sort of chivvy me out, but I hadn't got another gig. And I say, "But yes, but if I hadn't told that story, we wouldn't be having this conversation, and you wouldn't be forming the ideas that you're forming now. Isn't that what storytelling is?"
Yeah, it is.
It's like people waft around going, "Storytelling." I do sound sarcastic, don't I? If I sound a bit sarcastic and bitter, it's probably because I am. But storytelling will not change the world. It won't. But we used to say, it's been around for centuries. If it was going to change the world would have already changed. But what storytelling does, that is unique and wonderful, is if it's done the right way, it can create safe communal spaces where the difficult questions can be asked. And if those difficult questions can be asked and people can sit down and have a dialogue, then the world might change. And I love that.
Yeah, but that also comes back around to we've been telling stories for thousands of years, and we're still up the creek without a
Absolutely. So you just got to ripple out the kindness, my friend. Ripple it out
right.
there. Yeah.
But we are creating those safe spaces where dialogue can happen, and where empathy can be created, and where people can be supported. And if we can't create,
Absolutely.
if we can't create a safe world, if we can't change the world, then we can create these safe spaces where people can
And know that it's
shake
all
off the
right to
crap.
disagree. It's perfectly all
Yeah,
right to
right.
not have the same opinions. But yes, so yeah, I've had so many stories in my life because there's such a huge repertoire. I mean, my husband went on to Twilight Tales. We have a thing called Twilight Tales,
Okay. Is that
because
a podcast or what is that?
it's literally. Would you like me to tell you about that in a shameless plug?
Yes,
It doesn't
please.
cost anything. That went a long time ago
A
before
long, long
when
time ago.
dinosaurs roamed the earth. Before lockdown, BL, as we tend to call it, or lickdown, as my dyslexic typing tends to. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't come out. I'm in lickdown. Interesting. And then I'd realised I'd sent it, and there was nothing I could do about it. But most people know I'm dyslexic, and that's why I have a PA and various other people. But we were trying to record the stories, so it's really hard. And I'm going to give you my husband's email because he has drafts and all sorts of interesting things that I haven't even got in my head and don't want to see. But if you can imagine, there are 12 cycles of stories. Okay, the oldest one goes back just before 5th century BC, and the most modern one. And if this is a podcast, I'm doing air brackets at the moment. Most modern one is about 1700s. There's nothing past that. There are 12 cycles, And each cycle contains about eight sub-cycles, and each sub-cycle contains between 120 to 300 stories. A vast amount of those have never been written down.
And you know them all.
They're all in my head. I have a friend who's a surgeon, and one day they want me to tell stories while they're taking a scan of my brain. Now, there
Oh,
is a whole
yes.
system of learning called drashing. The midrash is a Jewish term. It just means to unpeel through questions, see what's hidden in plain sight. But the Drillers had their own way of midrashing, how to take a story and what's the most, and by asking questions, you expand it. And then you dehydrate it again into one image. And I teach my students the technique. And that one image is like a key image. And you pull up that key image, and then the whole story like reinflates in front of you. And you just tell what you see. That's all you have to do. It's an amazing technique.
Sounds
Yeah.
easy.
Takes me 3 years to teach most people and 7 years for them to kind of go, oh, I get it now. But there's about 200 people out there, whereas 9 years ago there was nobody. So,
That's incredible. I was going to ask you, are you training anyone in particular to have your 3,000 stories?
yeah. Well, the way we're doing it, first of all, I'll tell you about my husband's panic
Okay.
as a folklorist. He said, "How are we going to get these stories down?" When we started this process, I was 40, 40, I'm 51 now.
Okay.
And it was like it was taking between 3 and 7 years just to find the time to get down two or three sub-cycles. And he was panicking. And one day he said to me, "How did you learn them? How did your brother do it? How did she do it?" And I said, well, it was very simple, really. We'd drash a story in the morning. I'd walk it for an hour in the afternoon. And in the evening, every evening after supper, she and I would like, she'd tell me the next bit of the story. I'd tell her the bit of the story I'd learnt. And
Oh,
we'd
so she
have
didn't
another
tell you the
bit.
whole, she didn't tell you the whole story. She just told you a part of it.
If you ever hear the stories, Simon, you'll realize they're vast. They
Okay.
are huge stories. They take days to tell. I can tell you a story in 20 minutes, I can tell you a story in 3 minutes, but the actual sub cycles, so the Ruby tree, well,
Okay.
what he said was, "How did your brother do it?" And I said, "Every night." And so he said, "Well, why don't we do that? Rather than doing these weekends that we do with listeners and that, where you still can't get them all done, why don't you just tell me the next bit each night?" And I went, "That's a fantastic idea, but you know what's going to happen, don't you? We're going to go, oh, don't feel like it tonight. Oh, watch this on Netflix. Oh, because we're human beings." And then I had an inspiration. I said, "But if we're accountable for someone else, we can't do that because we'll feel slightly ashamed." So we decided to set up a thing. It's just a Zoom meeting called Twilight Tales. There's a Facebook group called Twilight Tales, and the link is pinned at the top of the Facebook. And we started this at the beginning of lockdown, and every single night at 6:30, we'd turn it on. And I'll tell the next bit of the story. We expected a couple of people because we don't ever advertise it because it's free. I mean, if people want to buy a coffee, they can, but they don't have to. It's totally free because our hidden agenda, which isn't really hidden because we tell everyone about it, so I guess it's not really an agenda. It's just to record them. We need them. It's not a good quality recording, but then at least we have a recording. And we turned on the first night and there were 70 people in the waiting room.
Holy cow.
Well, yes, I said something very similar, Simon. But maybe a little more expletive. And then,
Something along the lines of Freaking Nora.
yes, very much so, yes. Oh, how well you speak the mother tongue. And we welcomed everyone. And we have been now doing Twilight Tales since then. We're up to 3 years now.
Wow.
Every night. Now we've had time off. We actually stopped on the 7th of December because I've had my surgery, and we're back. And the way we're running it at the moment is Simon does the Arthurian stuff on a Monday. I tell Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and we have a guest storyteller on a Wednesday. But we've built a community,
So,
and we tell every night. Now, we have managed to tell an entire subcycle. And if you go onto the Twilight Tales page, you'll see, Si's printed it out, it's over 1 million words.
oh my gosh, that's okay.
But there's a whole subcycle down. No, not a whole subcycle, a whole cycle.
Okay,
We've
I was
got
going to say, if it's a
the Ruby Grid.
subcycle, you're going to have to live to be like 150
I know,
to
we've
get
got the
these things
Ruby
out.
Tree, the Diamond Girl, the Opal Forest, the Emerald Sea, the Sapphire Starter. We've got them all, and now they're in writing, which is great. So we've started on the second cycle, which is cycle of Patient Hillel. They're all named after rabbis. Not because they have anything to do with those rabbis, they're more a geographical date stamp. And again,
Okay.
I tell on a Tuesday and a Thursday and a Friday, and I'm going to start again next week because I've got the week off because I'm poorly. But there's always something happening on that site. And the thing is, what we've created is a whole bunch of people that interact with the stories that go and do bits of research for us. We found stuff out that I didn't know.
So
And
these are the listeners that are doing this?
yes, they're
That's
amazing.
incredible.
They're like Mishbooker, they're like family now, you know. And we get between 70, 50, 30, never below 29 people.
Wow.
Because everyone's gone back to work now, but people still come every
Right.
night to listen. And it's something I'm really proud of because I think that's what stories are for. You were talking about safe spaces earlier, and the number of times people have said, "This has been my sanity through the pandemic. It's
Yeah.
been my sanity," or "This story has given me outrageous hope," or, you know, there's been an awful lot of support that's gone on. And the lovely thing is the connections that have been made that are external of me, you know, people that have met up because of me. So I came over to Pimpernel last year. And
I know, I
you know, there were people
so.
there from Twilight Tales that didn't know each other, and they all met up, and it was great. But yes, so these stories are being recorded with Twilight Tales, and then I'll segue back to the other question that you've asked, because I'm really sorry, I do get
No, that's
excited
fine.
on tangents.
Yeah.
Am I teaching anybody this?
Yes.
And the answer is yes, and in different ways. So,
Okay.
I run courses
Right.
where I teach the techniques for
Right.
people to apply to their own practice, their own creative practice. So I have everything from writers, storytellers, librarians, doctors, artists, sculptors, social workers, oh, you know, a whole gamut. Anyone, jewelry makers, anyone that for at the core of their practice, narrative is important.
Okay.
I take people on. I run online courses, and then I run a very big course that's like a month long in the UK. But from that, people often say, "Can I study? I want to learn the stories with you." So they'll come on, and then we'll teach them a little bit further in depth how to drash, how to hold it. And I have about 80 people that are learning. And what we're doing is we're not teaching them all the cycles because that would be overwhelming and people would lose heart. So what we're saying is, right, we're putting people in teams of eight. And we're saying, right, you're learning this cycle. And you're learning the Ruby Tree, and you're learning the Diamond Girl, and you're learning this, and you're learning that. So that when those eight people to come together, you have the whole cycle, you know.
That's
And
magical in itself because it's it's like this secret group, right?
Yeah,
The whole
again,
thing.
not very secret because you tend to tell everyone, but yes, and I love that what I want to do is just leave this legacy of these stories. I think it's important the tradition is acknowledged. I'm not even that bothered about me. Definitely Bubba would be acknowledged and all the women behind her that held it. So yes, we're teaching. I have quite a few students in the States, actually. I have three students that are going to go on and learn some of the traditional stories. They're going to learn. I can't remember which ones they said they wanted to learn because this was it. Oh, it was only decided in November. I have a lovely woman, Cassie Ashton, who is also going to learn a story. Nate Smith, who is an ITC, not ITC, intensive care nurse. How amazing is that? From Knoxville, is going to be learning these stories.
That's so cool. And you got Cassie interested in when you were there last year in Timpanogos?
No, I've known Cassie. She's done my Wildwoods course. She's done a 4-year course with me. She's
Oh,
going to come on and do some mentoring for my students because I think it's important to have mentors on a course because I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but you know when you know something really well, you have the curse of knowledge, don't you? So
Yes.
you don't say things because you think it's obvious. And my mentors are brilliant because they're not in awe of me, which I really like. And they'll go, Shanalee, you haven't said that. And I'll go, well, isn't it obvious? And they'll go, no, Shanalee, it's not obvious. Get a grip, say it. So they're much better. They're looking at it from a slightly different viewpoint. And their job isn't to teach, their job is to walk with the students and they get to do the course again for free and all the rest of it. So slowly we're building up people that are holding these stories, because what are legends do? Legends teach you about deceit. And so there's so much wisdom there. So my husband phrased it perfectly actually. He said, folk tales, stuff happens. Wonder tales, stuff happens and there's magic. Legends, stuff happens in places you can visit. Myths and sacred tales, stuff happens and there's gods.
That's
Which is a very simple explanation, but I like it. I
I
think
like it.
it's
I like that too. I mean, it really does sum it up. For an academic, he has a very good touch on reality.
Well, he's married to me. We've got a 20-year-old kid,
So,
all
where's your
crazy.
husband from? Is he?
He's
Is it?
a
Sorry.
Fenman. My husband is one of the mysterious Fenmen. He's
Ooh.
from the Fens. His father was a local doctor, and he went to study the classics. He lasted 1 week at Oxford and thought, I can't cope with these pretentious people, so transferred to Manchester. And he now teaches English classics, creative writing, and screenwriting. And he's an author, he's a published author as well. But he's from the UK, and he's a Quaker.
Oh, no way. My grandfather was
Yeah.
a Quaker, yeah.
Yeah, no, and he is one of the most patient, probably has to be with me, most patient. Amazing people. Now he is my son's stepfather, and he always was. But he's been Isaac's dad all of his life, pretty much. But when Isaac was really little, and Si and I were going to get married, we got married under a kippah in a Jewish way. But he also wanted to go and have a ceremony in the Quaker Church, and you have to have what's known as a meeting for clearness, and then you have to go to the service. And he says it's the first time he's ever seen two Jews sit next to each other and not say a word. Isaac kept leaning forward and going, when does it start? And Simon would go, it has, mate. Because you just sit there quietly for an hour.
Quakerism is very different. It's
Very, very different. So, yes.
yeah, it is. So
But yes,
you mentioned Simon. This is your husband.
yes, Simon Haywood.
Hayward, right.
Simon Hayward, Hewyward, and
And
he did
his
a great talk actually on for a TEDx talk that you can find on YouTube. It's called "Missing the Arrow."
And you can also find it on your website.
Can you? I
Yes,
don't
I
do my
think.
website. That's amazing.
Yes. Because I kept seeing this Simon guy pop
This
up, and I was like,
hairy guy, yeah.
yes, who is this man that she works with? So,
Every
so it
time I
turns out
lose him
that.
in public, I just have to say, he looks like a kind of a weird Viking. And
Yes.
people will go, oh yeah, he went that way. Which is great.
Yes, he does. He does. That's awesome. A redhead Viking, no less, I believe. Strawberry blonde.
Strawberry bomb Viking, yes,
Yeah.
bless him. But he's incredible. He's absolutely incredible. So patient. And if it hadn't have been for Isaac and Simon, I wouldn't be doing this. Because what I used to do when I first started telling, I had no idea you could be a storyteller. I learned to tell in my family. That's what I did. That was my heritage, if you like. I would just tell the story. And then I decided I didn't want to, and I wanted to do other things, all of which I was rubbish at.
I'm
So
sorry, can I
found.
can I interrupt and say, is that the universe, God, your faith telling you this is where you need to be
I
going?
just think it was my own ineptness and my dyslexia.
Oh, take the magic out of it for me, why don't you?
No. Actually, what it was, Simon, I had this dream one day where I woke up and no, I can't do it. But actually, I am rubbish at everything else. At the end of the day, I would have been no good at anything else. I did try a few things with hilarious and quite awful consequences. And then I went to a folk thing in the UK and I listened to some storytelling and I thought, gosh, that's awful. Because I am also quite a judgmental cow sometimes. And what I have to say was, this is when I was younger and I have mellowed with age, you know, in that judgmental way that 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds can be. And then
Yes.
I did some gigs for my bubba and I thought, actually, I like doing this. But I didn't think I could ever make a living at it. And then I found I'd gone to drama school, of which, and what I will say is, Bubba taught me how to tell a story. Bubba taught me how to ask questions of a story. Bubba taught me how to unpeel a story and tell it like I believe it and it's a memory. Bubba didn't teach me how to stand on stage in front of 2,000 people and project. That's what I got from drama school. And I think I realized you could do this, but I didn't think people wanted my tradition. So I did a quite a bad thing. I'm not proud of it. I mind swept my tradition for all the funny stories, of which there
Oh,
are many.
okay. Right, yeah.
And so I would tell these 3, 5, 10 minute very funny stories. And that's what I thought people wanted from me. And I got a rep as being this very funny storyteller, because I used to do stand up as well. And then it was the weirdest thing. It was so unsatisfying. And then one day I didn't want to tell the stories, because what I used to see was, I would tell a story, and if you watch Missing the Arrow, you'll get it. I would tell a story, and I'd see people in the front row taking notes, because it's tradition, isn't it? So it belongs to everybody.
Oh.
And they'd take notes, but they wouldn't understand the culture that it came from. Now,
Right.
I'm not saying you can't tell stories from other cultures. Please don't take that as a takeaway. But if you are, do your research so that you
Yeah.
understand the context and you're telling it from a place of skill, not a place of just verbatim, you know?
Thievery.
Oh, let's talk about that in a minute. And I thought, I can't tell the really deep, beautiful stories. And I got on stage one day and I told a story, it's The Diamond Girl. And when she is in great sorrow, she cries. And when she cries, diamonds fall from her mouth. And I told it because I knew I could condense most of the story into a 25-minute set, which is most places that's what they want, or 40. And this guy had been taking notes, and okay, well, it's, that was a beautiful story, but you got it wrong at one point. Now, we all miss, you know, we all say the wrong thing sometimes. It's an oral tradition, and you're not recording it. And sometimes, you know, you get the name wrong or whatever.
Right.
I said, oh, my goodness, did I? What did I do? He said, well, you have the diamonds when she cries coming out of her mouth. And I went, yeah. He said, well, they come out of her eyes. I said, no, they don't. Because they do. I said, do you know this story? He said, no, I've never heard of it before, but the diamonds come out of her eyes. I said, do you know, in Jewish myths and folklore, there are 32 stories about pearls. Do you know where pearls come from? And he went, no. And I said, pearls were the first gift that the Creator gave us. They come from your eyes. And the weeping of pearls brings relief. If you have those diamonds, you lose all those pearl stories. The diamonds come from the mouth, because you're thinking of beautiful, you're thinking of a beautiful image. But I want you to think about this. You are in sorrow, and there are things you cannot say, and you are pushing that sorrow down, and it hurts in your throat to do so. But it still comes up and it tears you apart. That's what those diamonds symbolize. Because her father in the story says to her, never let your enemy see you weep. Because when they see you weeping, and when they see the treasure that that will bring, you will have no peace.
Oh my gosh.
And I said, and you want to change that?
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, so then I didn't tell them for a long time. And now I tell them. And what I get is people coming up to me going, oh, I love that story. Could I tell it? And 90% of the time I say, because I know there's no other versions out there,
right.
I'll say, and some of the time what I'll say is, absolutely, if you can find a written version of that story out there, then it's out there, you know, it's not for me to say whether you can tell it or not. But you can't tell that version. That version has been thrashed through centuries of sinners. We can trace it back in our family 500 years.
You know, wow.
That is a story that's been thrashed by powerful women who have gone through adversity. You can't just cherry pick that. But if you can find that trope, if you can find that arc, and I often give them places to look, take that and go and do your own work on it. Absolutely, you can tell it.
Yeah.
And then there'll be an odd person that will come up and say, can I tell that story? And I'll go, why? Because I'll get a feeling, or Buddha will tap me on the shoulder. Because I don't know about you, but the thing about my ancestors is they never shut up. They're all just like a bunch of little old ladies there all the time, you know, with opinions. So I'll say, why do you want to tell it? And I had somebody from Canada actually recently say, could I tell the pain kettle? And I'll say, well, first of all, go and see if you can find a version. I don't think you will, because it's a very old story that has been held in Hebrew and Flemish dialect. Well, I doubt whether there's a version out there, but there might be. So God love them, they went and looked for about 6 months and they came out and said, I can't find a version of it. It's a really powerful story. I said, why do you want to tell it? And they told me. And I know this person and I respect this person. And I said, all right, but I'll teach you the traditional way. And the deal is you tell it for this, but you never tell it for profit. It's not what it's meant for. That is not a story that you get up on stage and tell for profit. If you want to tell it in a community to heal, I'm happy with that. But you do not do it for profit, because That's not what it's meant for. It's meant for a very different reason, and never have. I've been really respectful of that. So there's lots of different ways I pass things on.
Could you tell us that story? I'm kidding, I'm kidding, I'm kidding.
I can tell you the premise of it. It's basically a guy does a deal. He's a really nasty king. It's part of a much bigger cycle, and his name is Charybdis. Horrible man. And he does a deal, and he gets this kettle from Gehenna, from Ashmedai. And this kettle he gives to people that are really happy. But every time something happens and it hurts, penny drops in the kettle. And the more you hurt someone, the greater the reward.
Oh.
Until they find this couple who have been happily married, that the way that they can really make a killing is to say things that you can never take back. You know, so they sit there and he says, "I never loved you," and it's horrendous. It's horrendous. And the kettle is filling up and filling up and filling up.
Oh.
And it's called the pain kettle. And it has a, and I have to say, Charybdis gets his comeuppance, and
Of course.
there is a hopeful end to the story. But that's what I mean about, we want our stories to be nice and fluffy, and sometimes they're not.
Right.
And we learn those lessons, but we've been so used to everybody there, everybody there, and then we got happy and lived happily ever after.
Guilty as charged.
Oh gosh, we all need those stories as
We
well.
do. We do. We do.
Yeah,
We do. I mean, there are
there's a
some that,
lovely story. Yeah,
yeah, I
there's
mean,
so
that.
many lovely ones. Oh gosh, don't. Come to Twilight Tales one night, it's fun. Come next week.
I
I'm
will.
doing Miriam's Laughter next week, which is nice.
Okay. All right. And they st so when do you start the cycle? Or the
I
story?
started the Song of Lilith. I started the new cycle on the 14th of January, and it's the Song of Lilith. I always give a recap, and we are. I've been doing it kind of sporadically because I'm just when I think I'm okay, I think my immune system is struggling after the operation. It's like
Right.
I can't string a sentence together. So I'm starting again back on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, whatever the date that is.
Okay.
And we've only got as far as the young queen has crawled onto the beach to see Lilith dancing with all the ancestors and the women, and she wants help, and she's had three moments where she's lost consciousness, and in those moments she's remembered certain stories. So we've had, I think, the hare in the milk, which is out there, it's fine. The courage of the midwives of Egypt, which is hilarious. I love that story. And I'm just about to tell Miriam's Laughter,
Okay.
but we do that on Tuesday. We don't record the sessions for public, the whole point is it's the archive, but my husband is getting spookily excited because he's transcribing. But the weird thing is, he's running it through Otter and AI to get the transcripts quicker. And people have been saying, "I wonder what strange images you're giving the AI now."
Oh, yes.
Because it's taken to summarizing things. Let me see if I can find one. He's put a thing up actually in Twilight Tales this morning. And they used to, because they couldn't understand it, so Prince Phoebus became Prince Seabass, which is hilarious.
So you have to go, or someone has to go, and presumably not you if you're dyslexic, but your husband has to go through and like check these
Absolutely.
things and make
Well,
the
what he
changes.
does is he's also an editor, and he'll go through transcript, proofread, and then he puts it into a readable transcript, because you have to remember, I'm an oral teller,
Right.
and there'll be something where I might just raise an eyebrow
Right.
or make a gesture, and he has to, which is why he records it video and sound. He has to find a way to get that on the page without it being clunky.
Right.
So, and which is, he's a past master at that. But we went through, we decided to do something with the Mish Puppet the other day, the Twilight Tales tribe. And they wanted a children's book. So we spent about 6 months, we've got a publisher, spent 6 months going, okay, when we finish the cycle that we've just finished, what were your favourite stories that you thought were appropriate, bearing in mind most of the people that buy this are going to be adults, but and we've got about 20 stories, and we've got the most wonderful illustrator. If you want someone interesting as well, Catherine Suter Caddock is an illustrator.
Gotcha.
I don't know whether she uses cat yet, and she has been illustrating for me for years, but also for storytellers all over. And
oh, okay.
She is the sort of person that can draw what's in my head, which is amazing. And we sat down with this children's book and we thought, what did we want? And I said, Bubba loved Deco, Art Deco. So
me
we're
too.
Doing this book. Do you remember when you were a kid, you'd get those really old books, but you'd open them up and then they'd be like a thin film of like paper. And then there'd be the most beautiful colour plate. And then the story, and then, you know, little black and white borders and everything.
Yeah.
Well, we're doing a book like that for Bubba.
Oh, that sounds, that sounds. When do you think that'll come out? You have a publisher for it, so I'm assuming maybe
yes,
not
we have
a
publisher.
Year.
It's probably, we did have a draft ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was all on Simon's laptop, and he hadn't backed it up to the cloud that morning, and his laptop was stolen. But we have all the rough notes, and we are about 50% of the way of re-editing and going through, and lesson learned, really.
Yes, you know, yeah.
But I think what they're going to try and do is the minute they've been really good about it. And really good about the fact that I'm obviously in recovery, and it's going to be another 6 weeks before I'm kind of leaping small buildings. I'm thinking next year. It's probably we're going to try and get it to the publishers by this summer, but
okay.
It's slightly hampered by the fact that it takes 6 weeks per drawing for Catherine.
Oh, wow.
She doesn't move any faster than that because we've decided on quite an old-fashioned style, so she can't gel print it. She's hand painting every plate.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Mm.
That's incredible. I can't wait to see this.
There's a great one called The Cloud Sheep, and it's a Dutch story. Oh, can I tell you one more story really quickly?
Yes, you can.
You
yes,
can say
you
no,
can.
Shut up, Shona Lee.
No, but I know, so one of the things, so before you tell the story, if that's all right, one of the things I'd like to, what I'd like to ask you is, in your tradition, I have heard that if someone in the audience asks, you know, when you turn around at the end of a story, you know, when I tell the Goldilocks and the Three Bears, no, it's not, what is it? The Three Little Pigs, right? When I tell the story of the Three Little Pigs, the wolf lives to tell the tale another day, and his mother says, that's why you got to watch out for these little pigs, and he did. But then one day he met a girl all in red, but that's a story for another day, right? If someone says to you, no, I want to hear it, is it right that you have to tell it in your
yeah.
your tradition?
Yeah, you'll hear me if you ever hear me tell. My stories are peppered with, and why that is another story for another time. And you can stop me and say, I'd like to hear that story, and I have to tell you that story. And within that story, there'll be, but that's another story for another time. And if somebody else asks for that, then you have to tell that. And you can get what my husband calls the lattice, which always makes
Okay.
me think of a Greggs pasty, actually. But
Greg's biggest a food chain,
a
right?
food chain of dubious pastry notices. But they do a lattice bake, which I don't think has ever seen any meat in its life, but you could get mad. So yes, this lattice, you can get 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 deep into that. And then the real skill of a griseller is coming back and also saying to the listeners that don't worry, I'll bring you back. You don't have to hold all those stories in your head. I do, you don't. You just concentrate where we are as we move around this world, you know.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is. You'll also hear me say, but that's more stories than I can tell you this night. Now, I've done that. That's not part of the tradition. It would have been said at the end of a night, but it would never have been said in the middle of a storytelling. Because if you imagine, and I never say it in Twilight Tales because we don't need to, if I say that's more stories than I can tell you this night, it means if you ask for this story, we will leave this entire sub-cycle and go somewhere else. And it could take me months to get back to here. Now, if I'm standing on a stage, I don't want to do that. And the way I usually say it to people is, so I've put that in, you know, let's be honest about things. That's not in the original tradition. That would only have been said at the end of a night. I've put that in mainly to say to people, please don't ask for that because I will have to honour my tradition. And if I go off down this tangent, I'm not going to get back in 25 minutes and everyone in this room is going to want to kill you. So let's not go there. But somebody did once.
They did not. There's
They
always
did.
someone. There's
Yeah,
always
it's all.
someone.
I was down south in near Devon, on the coast, what we call the Jurassic Coast, because a lot of dinosaurs lived down there. And I was telling this story, and I'd said this, and what was I telling? Oh, I was telling the Emerald Sea. But there are points where these stories kind of, you meet characters again and again. So in the Ruby Tree, you meet Tobias, age 7. And in the Emerald Sea, you meet him a lot older. And in the Diamond Girl, you meet he's got married now. So you meet these
Wow.
characters all over again. And somebody actually did a whole family tree for the Manasseh cycle of all the different families and the
No.
way they interact. I have never seen it. Simon's got a copy. I don't ever want to see it because the weirdest thing is when I look at things written down, it's like my brain goes, oh, I can forget that now.
Oh no, don't look at that picture then. Holy
He was
cow.
drawing a map of the Ruby Tree once in our dining room. And we live in a like a cottage. And you know what the old sort of cottages are like in Derbyshire. So we got, you know, stairs in the middle of the house, one room one side, dining room, and then lots of little weird rooms. And to get to our stairs, because we've blocked off a door, you have to walk out of the dining room, round the back of the house, through the kitchen, through the dining room, and then into my husband's study, through my husband's study, and up the stairs. And every time he was doing this, I had to shout so that he could, because he'd got it on a long piece of paper on the floor. So he literally threw himself bodily onto this log so that I couldn't see it. And apparently, after months of this incredibly in-depth academic work, he said, I don't want you to really look at it, just glance and glance away. I just want you to see the size of it. Apparently, my input was, I think what you need is more stickers. Because I am a fan of stationery. And that's why I say he's the most patient man in the world. But yes, this woman down south, I'd said, don't do this. And I was telling this story. And I said, but that's more stories than I can tell you this night. And I was breathing in to carry on. And she went, I want to hear that. And I thought, oh dear. And I looked at her and she went, nah, just kidding. And I went, No, you said it. And you might be happy to, you know, this is my tradition, but I'm not. So that's where we're going now. Sorry, guys. See her afterwards. And what she'd taken us into was the Ruby Tree, which is three stories, three sub-cycles before. The Ruby Tree takes me, if I'm really motoring, just telling the arc with none of the other stories, I can do it in about 3 hours. And to get through the Ruby Tree, it was literally this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens. I was Hyla in 20 minutes and get back to the Emeralds.
Oh my gosh. Good for you. That's someone that knows their craft really, really well.
Oh, and also someone that's quite petty, I suppose, as well.
Well, I yes and no. I mean, you know, I just did that to you, right? I mean, I didn't feel that I was dissing your culture, but, you know, maybe that's a...
When did you do that?
A little earlier on.
Well, when you asked for one. I think you genuinely wanted to, though.
No, I do. I do. I do. I genuinely want a story.
Difference. If you genuinely want to hear a story. I remember doing a club in Cambridge, and they've got this little kid in, and a little kid did it. So I need to know. And I don't mind that, because that's coming from a place of honesty, isn't it?
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh, and I went, we can do this. What is it you specifically need to know? And he wanted to know about this firewall and what it was. And I just told him really, really quickly. And I didn't feel that he was dissing a tradition. I felt he was absolutely engaged in the story, and he was coming from a place of real grounded honesty, the way kids do, like you were saying.
Yeah.
And I felt that with you as well. And there are times when people can't stop themselves and they do ask, but most of the time I put both hands up as well. And I've only ever had it, but this particular woman, she was just trying to be mischievous, you know.
Yeah, and there are people like that who are just mischievous, and they don't think about the group. And I say this because I am one of those people, you know, which mischievous or a complete asshole, you know, it's a fine line. It is a fine line.
Yeah, or trickster energy is a really fine line, isn't it?
It is a very
fine line. We all need a bit of that, I think. The world would be very boring without that.
Well, I think so. I think so. And there's a huge conversation I could have about that, because the counterculture, or council, not the council culture, the council.
Dana Council.
Dana Council.
You can't come in here, mate.
Putting up signs again, you can't drive more than 20 miles an hour around here.
Yes.
Although that's in Wales, and that was a really bad southern accent, because I'm not in that headspace right now. But anyway.
You know, there's a reason why traditional stories are important.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why we remember them. And it's because they give us some wisdom and a common sense and a common understanding that we've all thought the same things before.
And a moral compass.
And a moral compass.
Yeah.
And an immoral compass sometimes, you know.
Well, that's true, yeah.
It's like I'm doing Lilith at the moment, and everyone's like, oh, Lilith, the feminine energy. Lilith is just chaos.
Why do they say Lilith, the feminine energy, in a negative light?
Well, they talk about, because Lilith is supposed to be a demon. She's not. She was the first wife of Adam. And a lot of the time when I'm telling the much older cycles, there's a phraseology that has an almost rhythmic quality, which is it's said in commentary. Now, commentary is the rabbinical writings around the subject.
Okay. All
so
right,
it's said in commentary, she's a demon, blah, 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 blah. It's said in song and story, because the song and story is what the women held. So you get this kind of... So what Lilith is sexual energy and chaos and untamed wildness. And of course, you know, that can't be good. You can't have women thinking for themselves, can you? Good grief. Where's that going to lead her? She's obviously a demon, bless her. You know, but there's a great line in Song of Lilith. She turns to Adam and she said, "If I was made from the same dust as Adam's breast, how come I be demon and he be not?"
Right, exactly.
Anyway, I've gone off
Exactly.
another tangent there. Sorry about that for me.
No, that's a good tension to go off. That is so cool. So your stories, the recordings that you've got for archival purposes only, are they going to the British Library or a copy of them going there for
I don't
safekeeping?
know. You have to speak to Simon. I think they're looking at. Oh, they have a whole team, or he has a whole team that's looking at archive and retrieval. And we talk to so many people, and the best advice we've got from archivists at the moment is shove it on paper, hermetically seal it, and put it in the British Library. Because if we'd have put it all on floppy disks, we wouldn't be able to read it now. And technology is changing so
Yeah,
fast.
right.
But putting it on paper, at least if it's hermetically sealed, gives it some a little bit more longevity.
Yeah.
Oh,
That's
yeah.
yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's yeah.
We hadn't either. It was an
Yeah.
archivist that said that to us.
So Shonalee, I do have a couple of questions for you. This conversation has been absolutely wonderful, and I really appreciate you spending all this time
Thank you. I'm going to
sharing your.
take my makeup off and go back to bed after this.
I saw that you were a not a courtesan, but a consort to Taffy Thomas.
Well, technically, I'm still am because I've never been replaced. But yes, I was. Taffy was the storytelling laureate, and because he was, older, they wanted someone young that could like go around and do stuff. So he decided that he'd like me to be his consort. But my mum, her English got her English is good, but at the time she was in the first stages of dementia, so her English was completely low. So she told everybody that I was Taffy's concubine.
How did Simon feel about
Well, I think it was all right. He was very Chrissy, strangely enough, but it was really hilarious. But I love Taffy's sense of humour. Taffy gave me away at my wedding. I've known Taffy
Oh, he
for
did?
my adult life, yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
And he gave me away at my wedding, and in his speech he said, "Well, this was a paternity suit I wasn't expecting." But my dad, my dad had graduated, died basically, and I didn't have anyone, and I went to him because he's someone I very much respect, and
Yeah.
Liz was there as well. They're like my, family.
Your storytelling family.
Yeah, so
Yeah, I
yeah,
do
it was
like I
great.
like Liz. I drop her a line and send her a postcard every once in a while, just to keep in touch. The other question I wanted to ask you was, what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you were younger?
It doesn't matter.
Okay, I like that. That's a really good thing. And that's a true thing too, right? It's a very true thing. I think it was when I hit 50 that's when that hit me, is that it really doesn't matter.
It really doesn't. People say things, sometimes hurtful things, sometimes lovely things, sometimes I wish I'd done things. But at the end of the day, it just doesn't matter. Let's
Right.
just be kind.
Right.
Do what we do.
Compassionate. Right.
And best practice. It doesn't matter. As long as I'm doing best practice, as long as I'm serving the stories, doing what I'm meant to do, it doesn't really
Right.
matter.
Your Baba must be so proud of you. Have you
Oh.
created a community up where you are?
Yes,
Up in
yes.
Yorkshire?
I go to two or three shows. I'm kind of the Dritzilla for the whole of the North, so I go to many
That's what I
tours
wondered.
up there. And I work a lot in Europe and Belfast as well.
Is that because of your connection with Liz? Or was that two separate things?
No, she took me to the synagogue years ago, and obviously we had a connection, but Liz is the person that sort of did that for me. But no, I work with a lot of shuls. I work all over, and I did for a while before my mobility issues hit, which I'm getting rid of. I used to teach the rabbis at Leo Bek Rabbinical College
Oh, really?
storytelling. This
That's
is how
awesome.
you unpeel a story. And that inspired me to co-found with a group of amazing women and tradition bearers the College of Storytelling.
Nice. And where's that? And that's
It's
in
that's in the
Yorkshire.
UK. And we run a lot of courses online, and we don't actually have bricks and mortar at the moment, which I'm quite pleased. We were just about to buy, and then the pandemic hit, so thank goodness we didn't.
Yes.
So yeah, we've founded that. It's five very strong women who have been incredible at supporting the tradition, and we have courses, we offer MAs, but we also there's going to be archiving and library and a way, and we run scholarships as well. We also help new artists with commission work and things, so that's
Oh,
something I'm
wow.
quite proud of as well.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's very, storytelling in the UK is, I feel, because I don't know, because I don't know enough about it. I feel it's really different over there than it is over here. There are more grants, there's more help to create the kind of work that's important, I think.
I think sometimes, yeah, I think the emphasis is on not so much on awards
Right.
and winning stuff, but about actually, yeah, doing something grounded that's going to last.
Right.
And that's not dissing anything that's gone anywhere else, but
Right,
this stuff that Mara's doing with her forest,
right. That's incredible.
incredible stuff. So you've got these amazing people and these women grounded that are doing all this incredible stuff. So how can we not be hopeful?
I know, right?
And that's
I
great, isn't
know.
it?
Yeah,
That's
it
so
is.
much fun. Oh,
It is
I'm
fun.
coming over in July as well, so maybe we
You're coming to the States in July?
I am.
What would
Well,
it
I'll
take?
have
'Cause
Kathy with me, because it will be my first big international flight without the aid of like all the wheelchairs and bells and whistles and stuff.
right.
So
So.
Cassie's very good at getting around the States.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm a nightmare because I'm dyslexic. I get on the wrong plane and I end up in all sorts of weird places. I was supposed to go to Singapore and ended up in Shanghai. I kid you not, I had to
Well, they
wait
both start with an
14 hours.
S.
Had to wait 14 hours for a connection. It was hilarious. And I phoned my husband, I'm like, he went, honey, there's nothing I can do. It's
Well,
the
not
other
only.
side of the world. You're gonna have to call me. You've got this, honey. You've got this.
But I can't believe that the people at the ticket desk allowed you to get on a plane going to the wrong place. I mean,
I
that's
know,
kind of
it's incredible,
bizarre
isn't it?
in and of its own right anyway,
I
right?
know. And Shanghai isn't such an international airport, so they all start speaking English at sort of like 6 o'clock at night. So everything's in Chinese, and I'm like, I haven't a clue. And I went up to this one woman who tried to sell me a teach yourself Chinese, and I'm thinking, even in 14 hours, I'm gonna. And then one really nice woman said, if you go and sit outside first class, they're still doing the announcements in English. So I got on the right plane.
Oh, of course, they're doing the announcements in
Of
English
course, darling.
for
There
first
he is.
class. Yes.
Yes, of course they are, sweetie. But yes, Cassie can get me around the States very easily.
Okay. So, Shanalee, my last question is a question that I ask most people on this show is, what is your favorite breakfast? Where would your favorite place be to eat that breakfast? And who would you like to be eating it with?
This is going to sound so boring. There is a restaurant now called Carluccio's.
Okay.
And when I was coming out the other side of my attack, my husband and my son used to scoop me up every Sunday morning. And I literally needed to be scooped up and carried. And they would take me to Carluccio's, who were very kind people. And we would sit there, and they would open half an hour early for us. And we would have breakfast together. And my favorite breakfast was poached eggs on toast and black coffee. Very boring. But we would catch up. And at the end of the breakfast, me and my husband and my son would all go, "Well, we're not dead yet. It's to another week." And it would be great because I hadn't realized that they had gone through as much trauma as I had. And it was just a way of kind of rebonding and also what I didn't realize at the time, my husband getting used to being out in public again without being scared. And so, yeah, poached eggs on toast, black coffee at Carluccio's with, can I have two people? My
Yeah,
husband, no.
that's
And I'm
excellent.
sure Bob is there in spirit.
I bet she is sitting there on your
Going,
shoulder.
what's wrong with porridge?
So my absolutely last question is, how do they cook the poached eggs? Do they do it in one of the little poacher things, or do they just drop it in boiling water?
No, they just drop it in boiling water. And
Excellent.
he showed me how they did it. Apparently, what they do is they drop the egg in a mixture of water and vinegar, warm water and vinegar, and they just put it in a bowl and they just slosh it, and it makes the outside of the egg start. And then they get the water simmering and then they just put it in hot water.
Oh,
And
that's
get a
really
perfect
cool.
poached egg.
Yeah, my granddad, that's how he, my granddad was a poached egg and porridge person, actually. And that's, he would always poach his eggs in dropping it in boiling water. My mum would have one of those little poacher, but she was a child who, you know, a mother in the 70s. So I think that's what everybody did in the 70s, right? Shauna Lee, thank you so much for giving me so much of your time for this conversation with you. It's been an absolute delight. I can't imagine a better way for me, at least, to spend today so far. So thank you so much indeed. I hope our listeners have enjoyed you as much as I have. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Simon. It's been great.
You're welcome.
We had a great time, and I hope you did too, enjoying our chat and learning a bit along the way. Thanks for being here. There are so many other places you could be. Shauna Lee did share a story with me, which you can find at Patreon by paying anything from $1 for an episode you enjoyed to a regular monthly subscription. In return, you get extras like the story, early releases, and other exclusive content on my work. That's www.patreon.com/Simon Brooks. It takes around 4 hours or more to make each episode, not including getting in touch with folks, setting it all up, and the marketing before and after. And I don't have advertisers. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Be sure to check out other episodes that you might have missed. You can find me and my work on Facebook and my website, Simon Brooks Storyteller, and on Instagram, Simon M. Brooks. Diamond Scree? Yep, that's me, the English fella and storyteller. Sign up for newsletters and more. A shout out to Chris Jett for creating and recording the music for me for my podcast. His band is called Blackpool Mecca. And again, help keep the podcast going and support the arts by becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/Simon Brooks. Cheers.
It's just a story.